Hello and welcome to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, bringing you a program dedicated to the life of the mind. In this program, we interview Jack Douglas, geologist, paleobotanist and sportsman. Sadly, Jack died in February this year, just before I was to ring him about this podcast. He was a great character, an athlete who represented Australia. He played two seasons at centre-half back for Hawthorn in the early 1950s, and after beating John Landy in a 440-yard race, almost made the 1956 Olympic team. Jack's professional life was mainly with the Geological Survey of Victoria. During that time, he edited the Victorian Government's Geology of Victoria in the 1970s. In fact, he made a significant contribution to the exploration of Victoria himself. And then later, he got the first 1 to 250,000 geological map series published. He published a major work on the geology of the Otways and contributed chapters on geology and sport to the Atlas of Victoria. He gained an international reputation as a paleobotanist and published a range of works on Mesozoic floras, notably What Fossil Plant Is That for the Field Naturalist Club of Victoria. He was a pioneer palynologist, working with fossil pollen before the word was even known. He was a field naturalist since boyhood. I visited Jack in his retirement down in Warrnambool in the company of Dr. Doug McCann, who is a science historian, amongst other things, and was at the time the honorary librarian from the Royal Society of Victoria.
Books have always had a most important feature of my life, but I was brought up in a system, really. It was, compared to now, these days, starved of books. The schools didn't have great libraries. Most of the households where I lived in the Otways would hardly had a book in the home. But from the earliest days I can remember, I always seized upon anything that I could read. But one of my greatest joys when I was a little boy, say from about 5 to about 10 or 12, was receiving from my auntie in Melbourne bundles of comics which her children have read, and she was good enough to send to me in the country. So, well, it was a wonderful for the postman to come and bring these rolls of, and although they were comics, I was always a...
Do you remember which comics?
Yes, I remember one was called The Puck. And later on, when I was just starting secondary school, and after I'd come to Melbourne when my dad joined the army and the start of World War II, there was The Champion, featuring wartime heroes, Rockfist, Rogan, etc., etc. There's one I remember, and so on. Yes, I well remember, harking back, the joy that books gave me from the very earliest time. I find the net sort of hard to get onto bits. I'm not quite computer illiterate, but getting that way. So I retain an array of professional geological, paleontological, environmental books, and very much I'm a creature of the written word. My dad taught nature study at primary school. I think one of the books was Leach's Nature Study, was it, Victoria?
Got a copy.
Yes, and I think it's a wonderful book. Then later on there was Charles Barrett, and he had a journal. I think the Herald published it. I can't remember the name of it, but it was I read that avidly. But I was Catholic in my reading, but I was a great follower of romance, like I suppose most boys, romance and daring do. I read the normal books in those days, you know, the Robert Louis Treasure Island, Robert Louis Stevenson, the boys' books. Television is... Certainly, I would say, I don't know any of my 15 grandchildren who are so into books as I was. They are very computer literate, and there's nothing wrong with that. But I'm a person of the book age. I come from the old Australia, where my interests were very much inclined to active things. I was not a particularly good student for most of my school life, and getting on to science, however, one has to take some specific subjects when one gets into what was in my day called leaving and matriculation. Now it's VCE, I think. and you had to choose some subject, but so little did I know what to do with my life, or so that I just chose a mixture. I chose English. In fact, my matriculation subjects, as I remember, were English expression, English literature, British history, chemistry and physics. I had no idea what I wanted to be, but I knew I didn't really want to sit all my life in an office. But anyway, when I got to matric, I had this form put in front of me, and you could have gone in for law or medicine or whatever and so forth. I put down agricultural science. I had no more idea really what an agricultural scientist did than sort of, but it just sounded a little bit outdoorish. Then I went to the university, and I did what I would say was one of the worst undergraduate courses in science I've ever heard of. Right. Now, partly that was because at this stage, my father's pressures, which must have been a little bit more than I sort of perceived, started to grow on me, but also because of my sporting interests. I was very much involved in sport, and in my second year at university, I went to Hawthorn VFL Club. The captain was John Kennedy, later to become famous. Involvement very much affected my university career. But at the same time, strange enough, although I was able to play football, I had a nervous collapse back into the university, and the final year, I did part three botany and geology, and that explains my paleobotany involvement for the rest of my life.
Why did you choose those?
Well, remember I told you I had a forestry scholarship, which was kindly of the Papua New Guinea people held in abeyance until I got better. But by that time, I was in the running, to be selected for the Olympic Games as an athlete. So I didn't want to be in Papua New Guinea when my interest in life, sporting interests, would not have been forwarded. So I changed to science. But immediately after graduation, this is where you get how I became a geologist bit. But immediately after graduation, I went to England and competed in athletic events in England. My final year was when I really started to become a scientist. Most of my time was spent in training and athletic visits and trips and so forth, and holidays and so forth. And I did not do any geological field work or practical work of any description. And my leanings were towards botany. Anyway, I came back wanting a job, and in those days there were plenty of jobs. The University Appointments Board, which was in even in those days, which was to help students find employment, I wandered up and they noticed I was also qualified in geology. Go along to the Geological Survey. So I went along to the Geological Survey, just wandered in, and a complete different from setup from today. You can't just wander in today. You've got to pass 55 security guards and whatnot. But in those days, the Geological Survey was a public service, not as in these days as a government service. It served the public. Now what was called a public service serves the whims of the government. And probably rightly, but that was very different. So I just wandered in, somebody showed me, and I walked along, so I met a man in the corridor who happened to be the assistant director of the Geological Survey. His name was Dr. Bain. He was an Englishman who'd done some very interesting work in Nigeria, had some wonderful experiences. I wandered in, I spoke to him, he said, "What do you want?" He asked me what I'd been doing. I said, running in Europe. "Oh, yes, I come from Newcastle. Do you run at Newcastle?" I said, "No, but I ran at Edinburgh's." Anyway, "Oh, yes, but I went through Newcastle." "Oh, anybody that's been through Newcastle's got to have a job here," he said. So that's how I became a geologist. Would you believe it? Entirely, you know, these days it's almost hysterically funny.
That's how you got the job as a geologist, but mentally you were already... The interest was there, wasn't it?
No, I was more interested in botany. Botany seemed a little closer to nature study, which all those years before, wandering around in the otways of my father, or not one, but taken out in the, you know, in a little half-hour school excursion or something, and with only one or two teachers there, of my father teaching the class, botany was much, much closer. I don't think my father knew any geology, but he knew the birds and the insects and the plants and so, to some extent, right? But I don't think
the beauty of the forest appeal to
yes, you. Yes, oh yes, yes, absolutely. And that's a good entity. Yes, I always was spiritually aligned with forests.
Stephen McIntyre with some of Debussy's movement. You're listening to the late Jack Douglas in his study.
Well, I joined the Geological Survey at a time after World War II, which was very fortunate, really, because it was the advent of the bulldozer. Before World War II, the roads were basically, and I know, I was in the country, but made of horse and scoop. After World War II was the day of the bulldozer, and it was the advent particularly of the forestry track, which enabled access to large areas, particularly of Gippsland and East Gippsland and the Otways and so on, and far west of Victoria, which had never been, we didn't know about before. In other words, it enabled, facilitated very greatly the mapping of the country. In the Geological Survey, we had this, again, dictatorial, but lovable, and very, very much a scientist, director, Dr. David Thomas, and he was my director of Geological Survey. There are others later and so on, but he gave me my chance, so as to speak. All the geologists, by and large, and I'll get on to managers later, but the managers these days would have highly deplored, and did later on highly deplore, Dr. Thomas's attitude of letting every geologist but work hard in the line of work which he felt inclined. We were all basically given, this was before the survey was divided into sections, and there were sections for a great deal of my later geology, engineering, geology, mapping, paleontology, basin studies, economic geology, groundwater, which is very important, of course. But before that, everybody basically was allowed even to take an area he fancied. I got onto an area north of Terrell called Mesozoic sediments, because I was sent there to investigate a black coal find in the Tyres River, and that led to my lifelong interest in the Cretaceous, because this was Cretaceous coal. I went there and found this coal. I reported on it. It was only a lens, which even a very raw geologist like me could see. A cement works in Terrelgan had thought, somebody had reported this coal to them, oh, here's, we can get our own coal and mine them. And it was in a very restricted seam of coal, and even I, as I say, pretty raw, could see that they weren't going to make any cement works, any boilers or whatever in cement works on this coal. But that then led me around this coal. Of course, coal is compressed fossil plant. Around this coal were fossil plants, and I got interested in those. I had beforehand been given some specimens from another geologist's investigation around Freestone Creek and so forth, though I didn't ever do much field work there myself in the late Devonian, and I wrote one or two little papers on. We were encouraged to do that. And I must emphasise that I believe that Dr. Thomas's and his executive staff encouragement of the geologists helped to found some great geological careers. he instigated anyway this take up your own interest. Some of my colleagues about my age went in for example, I remember one, Jeff Bell, we went in for clays. Clay came in escorted on brick clays and so forth. Others went in for groundwater. Others continued in their mapping work. But anyway, I got an interest in plants, but that was very much kicked on by the commencement of drilling for the groundwater in Western Victoria and for oil and gas in Gippsland. Now, when the oil and gas investigations, or the very preliminary investigations, started in the Gippsland basins and offshore, there were no, and particularly in the water, groundwater here, drilling is a very costly business. And these people were looking for tertiary, basically, water, and in Western Victoria, and interested basically in the tertiary and late Cretaceous sequence in Gippsland. The early Cretaceous was regarded as bedrock, basically, just stop drilling. Rock is a very, particularly if a rock comes out as drill cuttings, because coring is not embarked upon in drilling, or wasn't in those days, because to core you got to stop drilling and put rods in at great depths and pull up cores. They wanted to know when they reached basement. One of the best ways of finding it out was paleontologically. And one of the best ways paleontologically was looking at fossil pollens. I was able to tell them when they'd reached the Cretaceous on a pretty primitive knowledge that I picked up without any teaching and so forth of Cretaceous pollens. So I became an interest, but not much work time, an interest in the mega plants, the large plant specimens. I became very much involved in helping oil companies and our own drilling people in looking at bore cores, and I got a bit more knowledge and was able to tell them what part of the tertiary they were in. Then I got interested in acid-insoluble micro-animals, micro-plankton. By that time, I'd become 5 or 6 years after becoming a geologist, I became very, very involved in my paleontology with this palynology, which, by the way,
was that a new word then? I mean, was that an established?
Yes, it was. I don't even know if the word palynology was used when I started. I was only looking at these submicroscopic. I looked at a microscope or objects to determine where the drillers got to in the section, and later on get a bit more refined and told them and what formation they were in the tertiary. And also, I wasn't keen on particularly continually looking down the microscope. Now, one thing, I'm a broken down old man now, and my hearing's not so good. I've had this affliction and that affliction, but my eyes are still good. I don't need glasses to read. I can read the phone book, etc., right? I think I may have heard of somebody giving it up in one of my colleagues in America because he wasn't doing his eyes any good. So I decided to sort of ease myself out of that a bit and get on to my mega specimen plant interest, which, by the way, I also used for stratigraphic and so forth use later on. That was the basis of my PhD, and then started publishing and whatever. And,
so you'd have been doing a lot of field work.
Yes. Well, that's another point. Thanks for reminding me. The mega plant business, the palynology was largely based on bore core. The mega plants was going out into the glorious countryside, into the bush. And of course, you don't find the plants so much in the Warrnambool districts under dairy cow pasture or in the mallee. You find them in perhaps the more scenic, well, that's not right to say that it's scenically beautiful, but rugged countryside, which suited down to the ground a person like myself who always, and it's getting back to the NERS business, always had tremendous energy.
You could climb those Otway hills.
Yeah, I could climb anywhere. I could do anything. I was immortal. And of course, I was able then to collect at the same time. And one of my greatest contributions to paleontology is not only right. Well, hang on, this sounds a bit. But I'm only. I know my place in the scheme of things.
Well, I know how steep those hills are.
Yeah, but anyway, no, I loved it. I also, by the way, did you get back to the mapping you were talking about? But I've got to tell it my way, and which I also loved. I did some of my best, most interesting and biggest contributions to mapping itself were on the 250 Thou series, particularly with the Mallacoota area, which of course was wonderful. And a case I forget, and bring this in later, but the bulldozers I mentioned quite seemingly some words ago opened up particularly far eastern Victoria, and I was able to go out and find square miles of granite. I was very well adapted, and I believe adept, of course, in long arduous traverses without a lot of the advantages they have today. No global positioning systems, for example. You get up and even with an aerial photo which we had of a massive forest in East Gippsland. And it was almost impossible in some ways to know if you're in that gully there or that gully there or that gully there, where you found the boundary between the granite and the Paleozoics and so forth. But it was such a broad-scale, unknown geological area that, anyway, I was responsible for putting a large granite batholith, which hadn't even been recognised before. It was rather wonderful sort of pioneering. Now, of course, they're refining those sort of things. But I was one of the last of people able to do find broad-scale geological features, faults and so forth, which hadn't been found. All geologists and scientists continually top up on the works of others. But I was in this very fortunate position of getting into these tracks which had been made where people before didn't have the access. I particularly had great input, I would suggest, particularly into the large post-paleozoic. I reckon I'm a pretty good feel of the geology of Victoria. Post-Paleozoic, in the Mesozoic, I have a pretty good appreciation of structure, and particularly the sedimentary layers and so forth in the basins. I had the opportunity and the time when the scientists ruled the public service. When I started in the public service, there was an administrative branch, professional branch, technical and general and women's. The scientific, the professional branch, the vets and the doctors and the foresters and the geologists, were sort of looked up to as sort of little gods. Of course, they scorned us and hated us and made jokes about us and so forth, and a lot of them were good blokes. A lot of ex-servicemen went into the administrative branch. Don't say they weren't far cleverer than us, but scientists ruled the roost in the Victorian public service. But then, wouldn't put a date on it, but say 1975 or something like that, then came the Master of Business Administration at Little Lower Kansas University for 3 months. And science was relegated to second place, or perhaps third place, and has been there ever since.
Jacqueline O'Gill playing a Scarlatti Sonata.
You're listening to The Study. I'm Craig Robertson, and in company with Doug McCann, I'm interviewing Jack Douglas, geologist, paleobotanist, field naturalist, and athlete.
I'm a past president of the Victorian Field Naturalist Club, and I've always had religious devotion to our natural history. I'm well aware and very much aware of the beauties of other countries in the world I've visited. It's a wonderful world, and I'm very anxious to retain as much of the wonder as we can. I deplore the continued destruction of wide areas of Australian bushland and Queensland and so forth. I think that's and forest and such places as Tasmania, clear felling and so forth. I think in 25 years' time, that'll be almost regarded as a criminal offence. I'm a passionate believer in Australia and retaining our Australian environment. That's very much perhaps increased by looking around here at Warrnambool, where the whole Western District countryside was completely cleared and transferred into a Monterey cypress environment with large tracts of these Californian trees and so forth. But again, you touched on the point, but there has been a wonderful return to environment awareness in the last 20 years. Government agencies, although they facilitate, and I think, I'm not sure if they still give taxation breaks for clearing a forest in Queensland and so forth, but they also, on the other hand, these land care organisations and so forth, have left a very heavy, what I think is a fine imprint in our part of the world anyway, where many of the farmers, except perhaps the most conservative, have been financially induced in part into putting windbreaks of direct seeding and so forth, which is getting us back, bringing the birds and the insects and so forth back. And I'll get on to the insect point. That's a large and neglected part of our environment. We'll make a real noise, quite rightly, about the loss of the helmeted honeyeater or something, but at the same time maybe getting rid of 2,000 insect varieties or species we don't even know about. Fungi and so forth may have future drug and good drug things and all that in them. Yeah, you don't destroy what you don't know about. The Aborigines live very close to nature. They had to understand what they saw and what they observed to live. They had to know when the whatever turned up, when the bogon moths were going to come and so forth. But they lived by the migrations and the prevalence and the seasons. And I believe they may well have understood in their way, when they came across the fossil plants, they would have known they were plants or realised or taken interest in them, I believe. Whereas our European forebears, coming from this is just my idea, of course, but that coming from maybe some of them did come from closer to nature, but I don't think they had the sort of living history of nature ingrained in them, particularly if they came from European settlement groups, London or somewhere, their Aborigines would have, and some of them would have been there putting their interpretation on what they saw, and particularly these fossils and so forth, and putting a correct interpretation that they were representative of long dead organisms. Of course, the word fossil may not have occurred to them. That interpretation of fossils, even in our European concept, is a quite an intriguing story in itself. You know, how did the Romans interpret them? How did we in our, I'm talking about our European culture, interpret them? There were correct interpretations and wild interpretations of them in the early days of European culture, the same as I believe it, and the Aborigine culture would have had the same variation of interpretations. I'm a great believer in the fact that although we've achieved incredible scientific achievement, not only in geology, of course, but self-evident, there's an enormous amount that we don't know. In geology in particular, and even in geological concepts, there are too many scientists, like, for example, the death of the dinosaurs. There's a little too much categorical support of one theory by scientists with self-interest in promoting their own theories. For example, dinosaurs may well have been destroyed or partly sent on the way to extinction by meteor impact, that we don't quite know enough to teach our children, that that is, I believe, we haven't quite got the evidence to have quite so categorically instilled in, say, children's mind that the dinosaurs died because of meteoric impact. I know it's hard to teach children without putting positive black and whites in front of them, but most scientific, particularly geological concepts, are not quite as black and white as the protagonists with financial interests in them would pretend.
Stories play a really important role in any culture, and in ours, the big one that comes from science is evolution. The evolution of life.
Yeah.
That's the big story it's got to tell. It's also got a lot to say about the possible structure of the universe and so on, but I think the one that really matters is the evolution of life and of human evolution. Do you have any sort of idea about evolution?
Well,
for example, do you see it as progress?
It's all very much bound in the fact that I'm a Christian, a practicing Catholic. However, I suppose, now this is getting into the deep philosophies and truths that you live by, I have perhaps a tenuous belief in God, not a blind faith. I'm quite happy. In fact, I know that there's been a development of life. My geological experience shows me that from the rocks there's been a wonderful development in life from 500 or whatever million years ago until now, a continual development, continual change, and I find no conflict in that with a belief in God. In fact, I don't regard myself as a deep thinker or philosopher and so forth, but if there's a God, and I say if, I see if, a God meaning an all-knowing deity, he could in any way, at any time, and infuse into us a spirituality or soul or whatsoever at any time in this development of life. Now, I think there's a long way to go yet before we can trace a very solid line in the development from amoeba to monkeys to us and so forth, a long way to go and so on. But I, as I said, and I repeat, at any time, at any place, in any way, God could create in us a being that's got some special place and maybe some hereafter. And I know that one of you was perhaps not a disciple, but a worker with Professor Plimmer, and of course he's been fighting for the years against creationism, and I don't, as I say, although I'm a practicing Christian, and Catholics are not known to be wholly sort of Bible bashers of quite as so much as some other sects, perhaps deplorably. I don't believe literally in the world was created in 2 days or whatever, and the rib was taken out. But I believe.
Looking at it from another angle, like, do you think it's possible to get to know God in some sense through nature?
Yes, I get to know God best through nature. As I told you, I'm a most impatient person. I didn't actually say that, but you would have gathered. It was about talking of meetings and so forth. Most impatient, neurotic, my son said, person. I get bored to tears with steep, heavy religious liturgy and so forth. Nature is perhaps, if it wasn't for the natural scheme of things, I don't think I'd be a Christian. Now, of course, a lot of people believe Christianity is the enemy of science and vice versa. I don't. Well, my involvement with science has, if anything, enhanced my wondering, I won't say shaky, belief in God.
I wanted to ask you about the sense of wonder, because you often see people refer to this in defence of science, or the opposite. That, you know, there's been conflicting views, say, like Wordsworth sort of thought that science destroyed the sense of wonder.
Yeah.
Somebody like Shelley.
Yeah. That sense of wonder, yes. In short, I find it hard to believe that this wonderful world of nature, even a blowfly is a magnificently organised thing, much less a human being. I've, and perhaps I'm influenced, of course. One's influenced by one's teaching, and perhaps blind belief, perhaps a little an ignorant belief, but I still believe that I'm still wondrously intrigued by the glories of nature, which leads me to believe that there may well be some, may well be some guiding force behind it. All right? And I can understand also, on the other hand, that some of my friends scorn the whole concept, regard it as ignorant belief and so forth, but I am very much a person influenced by my ancestry, and so on. But I hope you follow my...
I do. I mean, some people say we find the truths of science to be sort of lesser truths compared to religion or art or philosophy. Other people would say, well, it's the opposite.
Scientific
truth is the only...
Well, in a way, science is God, in a way, to me. I mean, it's hard to explain, but it's science... invokes the study of the universe about us, which, and I'm not getting too far away from Earth as at the moment, but science, well, even in unbelievers, it can lead to a wonder, don't you? Even in people who scorn the thought of them, and many of those as the scorn the thought of a divine force. But it's hard.
I just think that, you know, like if science was to achieve one great thing, it might be to find life elsewhere in the universe.
Yes.
Or even to demonstrate that life is inherent in the universe.
Well, I don't think that's going to tell you there's no God or anything like that to me. I mean, that may well tell you the bigger or better idea of it as a God.
One of those issues that runs... Well, this is a problem about confidence in science. I think you have the idea of knowledge as power from people like Francis Bacon, but then there's, on the other hand, there's a tremendous loss of confidence or cynicism about it, I suppose, or even hostility because of the bomb and, you know, all the technological, this, that and the other. And I assume that you still have a great confidence in it.
Well, yes, I've got no... I suppose that's getting the concept of good and evil and the use of scientific concepts, but mankind is mankind. That, or some people would say, there can't be a God with such evil and evil use of science and so forth. It doesn't occur to me so much. I think that's abuse of scientific knowledge, rather than anything which disappoints me in science.
Are there any particular arts or music that you...
No, I'm afraid in many ways, there are several ways in which I'm a dead... I like music, but I didn't ever have any musical education.
Do you listen to much music?
No, I don't listen to much music. I like music. In fact, I can be inspired music. I can be lifted almost to tears by music. Like many people, I'm a mass of contradictions, but I didn't have any musical... You've got to understand, when I was young, sort of any sort of sign of feminine traits was regarded as sort of you're a bit of a whoop. Now you're encouraged more to indulge in your abilities and so forth. But boys didn't do girls' things sort of when I was young, particularly in the country, right? And I was you know, one is a creature of one's childhood, for good or for bad. I love music, so I can be inspired to it, but I didn't have... I know nothing about it.
If you have a study here, you said before that was essential to you. You spend a lot of hours in it.
Well, as you get older, you get less active, and I told you I had an illness. The computer has been... When it comes to any technicality, I have my sons-in-law who set up my computers, and you know, and I sort of, and if anything goes wrong, I screamingly call. So I'm very much into getting my information and my geological information. I'm still doing research from the geological literature rather than from the net or whatever you call it.
So you spent a bit of time.
I spent quite a bit of time. I have
this year you published The Nature of Warrnambool.
Yes, that was more or less, that took me away from pure geological research. That's just a little thing which I was able, particularly in my illness, to get out with the backing of the Field Naturalist Club here, a little natural history story of Warrnambool, which I'm pleased with. Perhaps to sum up me, I have two retreats. One is the wood heap, and one is my room. I love a wood fire, but when I'm pressed, perhaps even tired, I can, not overtired, and go out to the wood heap. Perhaps even when I'm being annoying my wife, I can go to the wood heap and have my sort of active retreat there, or I can go into my room and look at some of my favourite books, some of my favourite geological literature. I'm a great collector of this and that. I've got a great fossil collection. I had to throw out a lot of stuff. I do hold, not in my study completely, as my Princetown place is full of junk. Not too untidy, but then, you know, I'm not a good thrower-outer, right? That tells you a lot about people. But in my study, nothing specific, but I have one or two favourite books. My favourite book, perhaps, is, I was thinking about that the other day, The Red God's Call. P.C. Wrens, that sort of stuff, you know, Beau Gest. Lots of good collections of old, perhaps early 20th century writers.
Miwako Abe, accompanied by David McSkimming on piano, played Debussy's La Fille aux Chevaux de Lin. I'll never forget when Doug McCann and I left Jack. He stood tall in his doorway. At his feet were some nice pieces of Mesozoic sandstone with fossil leaf imprints adorning his front veranda. It was the sort of photo you wish you had taken. Farewell, Jack. Thank you.
my study, among my museum bric-a-brac, cluttering the bookshelves, stones are quite prominent, of course. I don't have anything as spectacular as Jack Douglas, but they all have meaning to me. It's become a bit of a habit over the years to collect them on my travels. I can't think of a better souvenir of a significant place than a piece of the stone on which it rests. It's a pity about the weight, but at least you don't have to worry about breakage. My current favourite is a stone, a piece of basalt encrusted with a calcareous layer from an ancient shoreline around Lake Turkana in the Great Rift Valley in Africa. There's been a lot of interesting archaeology in this area of northern Kenya in the last 30 or 40 years. I like to think that some hairy little hominid foot once trod past this stone in some wild landscape, not unlike it is today. I've delved back into geology and its related subjects in my own projects over many years now. I did develop a love of it as a youth, a love that made it possible and attractive to come back to later in life. It's something that gets in your blood. The very language of it has an excitement. There are a few writers, not many, but a few that have engaged with this. Judith Wright wrote a couple of poems about it. Jack Douglas has dabbled in a bit of verse himself too. This is from his book, The Mesozoic Floras of Victoria. The dinosaurs came, the dinosaurs went. Just punishment for a life misspent. Consuming leaves in a manner colossal. Destroying plants potentially fossil. Gone forever? Nay, not so. Lying buried, I'll have you know, are myriads of fabled species, all entombed in extinct faeces. But geology hasn't had the sort of writers in Australia that have published elsewhere. The one that I know best is the American John McPhee. There's a great passage in his 1980 book called Basin and Range, and I'll just read a bit of it. This is John McPhee. I used to sit in class and listen to the terms come floating down the room like paper airplanes. Geology was called a descriptive science, with its pitted outwash plains and drowned rivers, its hanging tributaries and starved coastlines. It was nothing if not descriptive. It was a fountain of metaphor, of isostatic adjustments and degraded channels, of angular unconformities and shifting divides, of rootless mountains and bitter lakes. Thrust fault, reverse fault, normal fault. There seemed indeed to be more than a little of the humanities in this subject. Geologists communicated in English, and they could name things in a manner that sent shivers through the bones. They had roof pendants in their discordant batholiths, mosaic conglomerates in desert pavement. There was ultra-basic deep ocean, mottled green and black rock or serpentine. There were festoon crossbeds and limestone sinks, pillow lavas and petrified trees, incised meanders and defeated streams. There were dike swarms and slickensides, explosion pits, volcanic bombs, pulsating glaciers, radiolarian ooze. There was almost enough resonance in some of the terms to stir the adolescent groin. Well, before we all get overexcited, I'll finish there. Basin and Range is published by Noonday Press, New York. So I'll leave all you field naturalists now with a little mystery sound. Music in this program featured the following. Pianist Stephen McIntyre playing Debussy's Movement from Images, harpsichord Jacqueline O'Shea.
Jill with a Scarlatti Sonata in C, and violinist Miwako Abe with pianist Dave McSkimming playing Debussy's La Fille au Chevaux. And our themes, Ronald Farren Price playing the Bach Prelude in C and Elizabeth Anderson playing Handel's Suite No. 5. They're all on Move Records. See the study website for full details of those tracks and a link to Move Records. That's www.thestudy.net.au. And so, until next time, it's shut the door and reading lamp only in the study.